Welcome to the last of this afternoon's panels on the subject of progressivism at the national level. And this recalls to my mind the fact that there's been surprisingly little discussion these past 2 days of what's been going on in Wisconsin, which is, after all, the seminary, so to speak, of the progressive movement. Jonah Goldberg did talk about it a little bit last night. One also often associates with Wisconsin that entity called the Wisconsin Idea, which was a state-level notion of progressivism, and reflected the degree to which progressivism started out as a movement in the states, but preeminently in Wisconsin, with leaders like Robert La Follette and some of the other figures that Jonah Goldberg mentioned, Charles Van Hise, John R. Commons, and other members of the Wisconsin faculty. Actually, keeping with the National Review theme here, I found a nice sentence from Rich Lowry on this subject. He has a piece actually before the things really got tumultuous in Wisconsin, entitled "The New Wisconsin Idea." And he says, "The old so-called Wisconsin idea was that government would collaborate with experts drawn from the state's university system to craft progressive legislation. The new Wisconsin idea is that the state is broke." So I don't know whether that counts as an idea, Wisconsin idea, but it's a beginning. And this, of course, is proving to be true on the national level as well, which is not really a surprise. And in fact, I contend, and I think it will be borne out by the presentations you'll hear, that progressivism, like all forms of technocratic reform, like all technocratic ideals, has a centralizing tendency inherent in its nature. So it would have been unlikely that progressivism as a movement would ever have been restricted to the states, even if it originated there. Of course, the great book of progressive reform, and in a sense a founding document of American liberalism, was Herbert Croly's The Promise of American Life, published in 1909. And one of the insistent themes of Croly's book was the precedence of the national idea over the federal idea. In fact, the book has a pretty much unremitting hostility to federalism, to state governments, to localism. And generally, Croly's way of defining which politicians are good and which politicians are bad often has to do with their view of the power of the states. So Theodore Roosevelt, good. William Jennings Bryan, you know, deplorable, and so on. Hamilton, good. Jefferson, bad, and so on. Certainly this precedence of the national idea goes on to be reflected in the Roosevelt and Wilson presidencies, with World War I, as again Jonah mentioned last night, as a kind of, in some quarters, seen as a great opportunity for progressive reform, so that in entities like the War Industries Board, coordinating the American industrial economy, or the Creel Committee to coordinate American thinking about the war effort, reflecting that nationalizing progressive imperative. So the great narrative of American political history, at least since that time, has been grounded in this inexorable tendency towards the nationalization of all facets of American life, and that being a good thing. Centralization, the movement of power to Washington, is the fulfillment of the promise of American life. It's inevitable and it's necessary in order to counter the evils of business, in order to establish justice, and to establish equity and all other good things. So American history becomes cast as a series of conflicts between the benighted who cling to local and regional institutions, and the enlightened who plump for national ones. So from the anti-federalist-federalist debate, the nullification crisis, the Webster-Hayne debates, the Civil War, the New Deal, the Civil Rights Movement, the Great Society, culminating, of course, in Obamacare, the supreme achievement of human history. And by the way, you notice when the bill was passed, before we found out what was in it, the adjective historic was used repeatedly to describe it. Of course, I mean, anything is historic. Abu Ghraib was historic, but in the sense that they meant the term, it was the fulfillment of prophecy. It was a kind of addition of a wing or a transept to the cathedral of American liberalism, this national, all-inclusive Leviathan state ideal. So this is a fundamental narrative against which all of us have to push. So what do we do? Well, I think we need to disarm the narrative. We need to question it, to interrogate it, as we say in the academy, and discard it, if possible, and replace it with another. What I would call cussedness, is a good and useful thing. It did my heart good to hear my friend Bill Merkison rail against seatbelt laws a while ago. We need more of that. I want to hear Bill talk about light bulbs. That would really warm my heart. But we also need narratives. We need our own counter narratives. I think it was maybe Jim Glassman, mentioned Robert Higgs's Crisis in Leviathan. I think that's a terrific starting point for thinking about an alternative narrative about the rise of national institutions. At any rate, these three presentations today, I think, are beginnings of the process of rethinking the narrative and coming up with an alternative to it. Our first speaker is Matthew Spaulding. Matt is the director of the B. Kenneth Simon Center for American Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He's a constitutional scholar, an authority on American political thought and religious liberty. He's project leader of Heritage's First Principles Initiative. His latest book, We Still Hold These Truths, Rediscovering Our Principles, Reclaiming Our Future. In this book, he details America's core principles, shows how they've come under assault by modern progressive liberalism, and he lays out a strategy to recover them. Matt Spaulding.